First up tonight, I'm very happy to welcome Amanda Copeland. A native of Washington State, Amanda Copeland received her BA from the University of Oregon and MFA from the University of Minnesota. She has been a fellow at the Fine Arts Work Center in Provincetown, of which we're very proud, as well as a fellow at the Ledig House International Writers Residency Program in Ghent, New York. She is the recipient of the White Writers Award and was named a 5 under 35 author in 2013 by the National Book Foundation. Her debut novel, The Orchardist, which we have on sale over there, won the 2013 Washington Book Award and the 2014 Reader's Choice Award at the Oregon State Book Awards. Please join me in welcoming Amanda.
Hi, everyone. Is this volume okay? Okay. Is that okay? A little bit better? Okay. Oh, I am so happy to be here. I love Provincetown so much. I was just in Portland, Oregon. I can't believe that one is able to fly from Portland, Oregon to Boston in 5 hours. And it feels weird to be here because whenever I've been here, I've driven from Minnesota. When you're here, you feel like you deserve to be here, but I kind of feel like, oh, I didn't earn this trip. I just blinked, and I'm in Provincetown, and this is one of my favorite places on the planet. So I'm so honored to be here. I am working on a new book, and when Matt asked me to read, I thought, ooh, I'm going to read a new chapter, and that did not happen at all. It's completely undercooked. So I'm going to read from my book, The Orchardist. I'm going to read a few bits from the opening, so I don't really have to explain that much. And it's sort of fitting, since I worked on this book while I was here, so the book feels comfortable here. His face was as pitted as the moon. He was tall, broad-shouldered, and thick without being stocky, but one could see how he would pass into stockiness. He had already taken on the barrel-chested sturdiness of an old man. His ears were elephantine, a feature most commented on when he was younger, when the ears stuck out from his head. But now they had darkened like the rest of his sun-exposed flesh and lay against his skull more than at any other time in his life, and were tough, the flesh granular like the rind of some fruit. He was clean-shaven, large-pored, his skin was oily. In some lights, his flesh was gray, others tallow, others red. His lips were the same color as his face, had given way to the overall visage, had begun to disappear. His nose was large, bulbous. His eyes were cornflower blue. His eyelashes, nothing to speak of now, but when he was young, they were thick black, and his cheeks bloomed, and his lips were as pure and sculpted as a cherub's. These things together made the women compulsively kiss him, lean down on their way to do other chores, collapse him to their breasts. All his mother's sisters he could no longer remember from Arkansas, who were but shadows of shadows now in his consciousness. Oh, my lovely, they would say. Oh, my sweet lamb. His arms were sun-darkened and flecked with old scars. He combed his hair over his head, a dark, sparse wing kept in place with pine-scented pomade. He regarded the world, objects right in front of his face, as if from a great distance. For when he moved on the earth, he also moved in other realms. In certain seasons, in certain shades, memories alighted on him like sharp-taloned birds, a head turning in the foliage, lantern light flaring in a room. And there were other constant preoccupations he likewise half acknowledged, in which his attention was nevertheless steeped at all times. Present and past projects in the orchard, desires he had had as a young man, worries, fears of which he remembered only the husks, trees he had hoped to plant, experiments with grafting and irrigation, jam recipes, cellar temperatures, chemical combinations for poisoning or at least discouraging a range of of pests, deer and rabbits and rodents and grubs, a universe of insects, how to draw bees. Important was the weather and patterns of certain years, the likelihood of repetition, meteorologically speaking, what that would mean for the landscape, the wisdom of the almanacs, the words of other men, other orchardists, the unimportant, but mostly the important words. He thought of where he would go hunting next fall, considered constantly the state of his land, his property, his buildings, his animal. And mostly he thought of the weather that week, the temperature and existence of, or potential for, rainfall, recent calamities and how he was responding to them, the position of the season, his position in the rigid scaffolding of chores, what he would have to do that day, that afternoon and evening, how he would prepare for the next morning's work, when were the men coming and would he be ready for them. But he would be ready for them, he always was. He was nothing if not prepared. He considered those times in life when he had uttered words to a person, Carolyn Mitty or Clee or his mother, or a stranger who had long forgotten him, he wished he had never uttered, or had uttered differently, or he thought of the times he remained silent when he should have spoken as little as a single word. He tried to recollect every word he had ever spoken to his sister, tried to detect his own meanness or thoughtlessness, his own insensitivity to certain inflections she might have employed. How long ago it was now. At times he fretted about forgetting her, though in fact he did not like to admit this. He had already forgotten much. Now at his back, the shrouded bushels of apples and apricots rustled in the wagon bed, the wagon creaking forward beneath the weight, the old, old, familiar rhythm in accordance with these leagues of thought, dazzled and suspended by the sun, the mountains cold at his back. It was June, the road was already dusty. His frame slightly hunkered down, the floppy calfskin hat shielding his brow, under which was a scowl holding no animosity. The large hands, swollen knuckles, loosely holding the reins. From the wheat fields he entered the town and drew down the main street. Quiet. It was Sunday. The nearer church, he thought, the Methodist was on the other side of town, had yet to release its congregation. He hitched up outside the feed and supply store, watered the mule. While he was setting up the fruit stand, tugging forward each burlap-covered bushel in the back of the wagon and unveiling them and unloading them, a woman rounded the corner and gained the platform, approached him. Half her face was mottled and pink as if burned, her mouth an angry pucker. She held defensively to her breast a burlap sack and bent and inspected the up-tilted bushel of Arkansas blacks. She reached for an apple but did not touch it, glanced dubiously at a bushel of paler apples he presently uncovered. What are those? He glanced down. Greenings, Rhode Island greenings. When he spoke, his voice was low and sounded unused. He cleared his throat. The woman waited, considered the apples. All right, I'll take a few of those. From the fold of her skirt, she brought out a dull green change purse. How much? He told her. She pinched out the correct change and handed it to him. As he filled the sack with fruit, the woman turned and gazed behind her, said, look what the cat drug in. Those two looking over here like that, you aren't careful, they'll come rob you. Hooligan looking, she sniffed. After a moment, he looked where she nodded. Down the street under the awning of the hardware store, two girls, raggedy, smudged-faced, stood conspiratorially, half-turned toward each other. When they saw Talmadge and the woman observing them, they turned their backs to them. He handed the burlap sack to the woman, the bottom heavy and misshapen with fruit. The woman hesitated, still looking at the girls, then turned and nodded shortly to him, stepped off the platform, moved down the street. From the wagon, he retrieved his wooden folding chair and sat down next to the bushels. Wind gusted and threw sand onto the platform, and then it was quiet. Rain was coming, maybe that evening, or early the next day. The girls moved, stood now with their shoulders pressed together, looking into the window of the dry goods store. A gust of wind blew their dresses flat against their calves, but they remained motionless. He pulled his cap low. What did two girls mean to him? He dozed, woke to someone addressing him. That you, Talmadge? Those girls just robbed you. He righted his cap. A slack-mouthed boy stood gaping at him. I saw them do it, said the boy. I watched them do it. You give me a nickel, I'll run them down and get your apples back for you. The girls had gotten farther than Talmadge would have expected. They made a grunting sound between them and their effort at speed. Apples dropped from their swooped-up dresses, and they crouched or bent awkwardly to retrieve them. The awkwardness was due, he saw, to their grotesquely swollen bellies. He had not realized before that they were pregnant. The nearer one, smaller, pouting, her hair a great hive around her face, looked over her shoulder and cried out, let go the hem of her dress, lurched forward through the heavy thud of apples. The other girl swung her head around. She was taller, had black eyes, the hard startle of a hawk. Her hair in a thick braid over her shoulder. She grabbed the other girl's wrist and yanked her along, and they went down the empty road like that, panting, one crying at a hobble trot. He stopped and watched them go. The boy at his side looked wildly back and forth between Talmadge and the ragged duo. I can get them, I can catch them, Talmadge, he said, wildly back and forth. Talmadge, the boy repeated. Talmadge watched the girls retreat. So I'm skipping a little bit forward in the novel, but this is the next thing that happens in the present situation of the novel. If that makes sense. 3 days after he saw the girls in town, he was braced aloft in an apricot tree on the homestead and saw them come out of the upper forest. He quit the shears and watched them. It was morning. They paused at the tree line and then came down through the pasture, their dark hair like flags riding the grass. At the edge of the yard, they hesitated, discussing between themselves what, glancing repeatedly at the cabin, the outlying land. He climbed out of the tree, the shears clamped in his armpit. When he walked out of the orchard, the taller girl, the one with the braid over her shoulder, turned to him and froze. The other girl, her hair also dark, but fuzzy, tangled, unkempt, had been chattering to the other, but ceased abruptly when she saw him approaching. Both stood watching him, their eyes swarming the shears. He halted 20 yards from them. You all lost? He called. They looked away at the trees. The shorter one, younger one, he decided, held her mouth open and panted slightly. Their faces were filthy. Even from where he stood, he saw their arms discolored with dirt. He crossed the yard and went into the cabin. He laid the shears on the table and took his time stoking the ashes in the wood stove. When he went outside again, they had come closer but fainted back when he came out onto the porch. He took the bucket near the door and went down to the creek and gathered water. Returning to the cabin, mounting the rise in the orchard, he saw that the lawn was empty. Then he saw them. He tried not to fix them directly, where they lay now in the border between the lawn and the outer grass, peering out, thinking themselves hidden. In the cabin, he rebuilt the fire and made thick cakes out of meal and creek water and fried them over the stove, lost himself in the task. When he came to, he thought, why was he making so many? And then he reminded himself, the girls had come to eat with him. He set the cakes on the table along with an uncapped jar of milk. He hesitated. Finally, he left the cabin, shears in hand, and walked to the apple orchard, a deeper section up the creek, leaving them to themselves. Late afternoon, when he returned to the cabin, there was no sign of them. The food had been eaten. The plates were clean. They had even eaten the crud off the griddle top, the charred remains of the meal cakes. The bowl on the table was empty of fruit. He stood for a moment, then checked the coal pantry. They had taken his eggs and milk. Backing out, he checked the cupboard by the stove. They had taken his cornmeal and salt. He waited a moment, then went out onto the porch and looked across the lawn at the trees. They were not here any longer, he thought. They had gone. He looked at the trees. Dusk settled within the branches, touched the ground. Inside, he took off his boots and slept. So I'm going to read one more short passage, and this comes about 40 pages later. And these girls are sisters, we learn, and Talmadge learns. They're young and pregnant, we already know that. Their names are Jane and Della. Jane is the older one. Della is the younger one. Or did I say younger and younger? Jane is the older. Della is the younger. And they, Talmadge and these girls develop this relationship where they sort of stalk his property and don't talk to him and ignore him when he tries to communicate. And then he feeds them food and they eat the food, and he gives them blankets and even makes a place for them to stay. But they're not on friendly terms yet. They entered the cabin repeatedly while the man was not there, and were touched each time, irremediably and despite themselves, they did not discuss this, by the domestic warmth. If such a house existed, why could it not be theirs alone? The boards creaked and sang beneath their weight. The plate glass windows, recently washed, were streaked, admitted soapy light. The pine countertops fairly gleamed. A black cast iron stove stood kingly against the back wall. The range had a stone top. A bucket with ashes sat on a shelf beneath it. On the back burner sat a scuffed navy blue kettle. Above it, on the top shelf of a doorless cupboard lined with newspaper, sat a white coffee pot and dishes. Between the range and the stove was a low-slung hamper stocked with wood. On the opposite side of the stove was a white porcelain basin and a pitcher of water, and above it a dented oval mirror glass hanging from the wall by a wire. On a tin tray sat a black comb and container of pomade. An almanac calendar from the year 1865 hung beside the mirror glass. A small walnut table, more rectangular than square, and two chairs were situated before the wood stove, filling the area between kitchen and sitting room. In the sitting room, a horsehair love seat stood against the wall, and beside it in the corner, a horsehair chair, the seat tattered and lumpy. Near the chair was a shelf of old almanacs, newspapers, magazines. Before the love seat was a rug of hooked fabric scraps, rose and green and purple, and in the opposite corner a steamer trunk and a rocking chair, so old and delicate it seemed to have sprouted from the room itself. This was where the sun came and lay, and the rocker, which was mahogany, was rung of color. The odor of the room was baked fruit, beeswax, pine, and old newspapers. There was an apricot tree in the orchard that was perfect for stepping up into. Once one of the girls did this, a curved branch invited another step up, and a branch above that dipped slightly in the middle, inviting a hand to grip it for leverage. Once one girl had situated herself on the second tier of branches, the other was able to climb up as well and situate herself on the level slightly lower. The branches had formed to the girls slightly reclining positions to the arches of their feet, their strange girth. They climbed up there until the wood became soft under their palms and feet. From here they could watch whatever was happening below in the field. And if they climbed higher into the tree, which they had done, they could locate the man wherever he was working. They were camouflaged, or they thought they were, and suspended, safe from danger, on the ground. There was a type of heat and light that was direct and overhead and bleached the orchard of color. The orchard at noon on the hottest days. And then there were the mornings when the air was soft, blue and soft, and the leaves of the trees looked like velvet. There were times when the girls knew where the man was in the orchard, and times they did not. These times they trod slowly and carefully, not that they thought he would harm them, not really, but it had become a kind of game. You might turn the corner into an orchard row and find him there walking toward you or away, or maybe you saw his legs, his trunk, obscured in leaves. Della, distracted for a moment in the heat of the day, the sun hung high and sweat trickled down the back of her skull, turned the corner and almost ran into him. She stepped back and held very still, did not look up at him, said lightly before she stepped around him, "Afternoon." He had become for them not a threat, though he was not devoid of threat. Why had he taken them in? Why did he stand for them to roam the place without demanding anything from them? And this threat entertained them more than the fact that they were curious about him. They were not interested at that point in the history or emotional life of men they encountered. This was not a rule they had set up for themselves, but rather a consequence of their experience. It was only important to know, to sense, but also to recall, if the man before them would fly into a rage, would lunge at them, was capable of swift and unremitting violence. And yet Della found herself those hot days roaming the avenues, struck by a sharp and intermittent desire to see this new man's, this orchardist's face. She was dissatisfied with seeing the front of his overall pockets, his denim legs and trees, his large burnished hands hanging at his sides. Through glances, she had caught his various features, his nose, the set of his shoulders, the striking color of his eyes. But he had one of those complicated faces that one had to consider at length to understand how emotion lay on it, to understand it at all. It was like a landscape, that wide and complicated, many-layered expanse. She wanted to study his face because it was different in an important way, but she did not know exactly how. Thank you very much.
That was wonderful. Thank you. Next up, we have Gregory Pardlow. Gregory Pardlow is the author of Totem, which received the APR Honickman Prize in 2007 in Digest, recently from Four Way Books. His poems have appeared or are forthcoming in American Poetry Review, Boston Review, The Nation, Plowshares, Tin House, as well as anthologies including Angles of Ascent, the Norton Anthology of Contemporary African American Poetry, and two editions of Best American Poetry. He is the recipient of a New York Foundation for the Arts Fellowship and a Fellowship for Translation from the National Endowment for the Arts. An associate editor of Kalalu, he is currently a teaching fellow in undergraduate writing at Columbia University. Please join me in welcoming Greg.
Thanks, Amanda. That was fantastic. And thank you, Matt. I think I'm honored to be here. I got the email from Matt. Matt said, you know, so we have this tradition where we invite someone to read at the end of the first meeting for the jury, and we've elected you to give the reading. I thought, wow, what a great honor. And then having spent the day savaging poems with this group of people, I kind of feel like a sacrificial offering at this point now. And I get back to the room and I'm looking at my poems and I'm like, they all do everything we've been complaining about. Written by himself. I was born in minutes in a roadside kitchen, a skillet whispering my name. I was born to rainwater and lie. I was born across the river where I was borrowed with clothespins, a harrow tooth, broadside sewn in my shoes. I returned, though it please you, through no fault of my own, pockets filled with coffee grounds and eggshells. I was born still and superstitious. I bore an unexpected burden. I gave birth, I gave blessing, I gave rise to suspicion. I was born abandoned outdoors in the heat-shaped air, air drifting like spirits in old windows. I was born a fraction and a cipher and a ledger entry. I was an index of first lines when I was born. I was born waist-deep, stubborn in the water, crying, ain't I a woman and a brother? I was born to this hall of mirrors, this horror story. I was born with a prologue of references, pursued by mosquitoes and thieves. I was born passing off the problem of the 20th century. I was born. I read minds before I could read fishes and loaves. I walked a piece of the way alone before I was born. So my aunt, I get this email. On my mother's side, they're aunts. On my father's side, it's an aunt. I get this email from my aunt. That's a picture of this guy, black dude, in this really, you know, zoot suit, practically. I'm thinking, why is she sending me this picture? And it occurs to me that she means to send it to my father, who's the same name. So why is my aunt sending him this picture? The subject line says Atlantic City pimp. And I just really fascinated. What's coded? What is she suggesting here? Attachment, Atlantic City pimp. Left of the at sign, the email address was ethnically gendered with the nonce noun sista, which I have to confess, I scoffed at, thinking it was from some self-discovering student of mine, before realizing it was my aunt who sent the JPEG from her cell phone. My aunt, who doesn't mind a bit of shell if it means getting all the crab meat, who is known to only leave behind enough of a tip to shame the wait staff for their inattention. The subject line read AC pimp, as if her painted nails and belly laugh made her expert in the fauna of pimps, a soul-stirred savant of things cold-blooded, as if she could divine an ivory-handled derringer holstered at his breast, icing the steel heart cognate to the gun, that twin ventriloquist of tinder and sulfur dust, that rhythmic and delicate organ pumping like a fist that has a knack for snake eyes and the superfluity of bruises that follow every spaghetti-strapped back talker's doubt. She must have thought she'd reached her brother, my father, who harbors, like a gold molar, a taste for robin egg and mauve pocket squares, a flourish of trim, a hand stitch, lapels check-striped and foreshortened like Tyrannosaurus arms, and ostrich print Stacy Adams to match. The modest feathered derby contrasting all those boas festooning street lamps and mailboxes. But my aunt is no mere expert. AC may have been a random tag, but that word pimp bore the import of all us do-wrong men. She was, in effect, signifying the kind of humor that waters the eye, the double talk, the shadow dialect. Like her spite-tinged smile at a bridal shower, her patina of derision enlivened the photo. My aunt, who refuses to settle for a man less Christian than she is, finds everywhere despicable men. Hence the dozens via email, the critique like a razor inside a roll of 20s, the currency of our vengeance economy. Perhaps there was an untroubled sea just beyond the garish casinos behind him, a stilt walker or mime outside the frame, a carnival and boardwalk where the horizon would be, and a tour bus full of people waving. Of all the images that might speak to something inside her, this was the one she found worth saving. So I'm playing with a lot of forms in this collection. I'm going to read a few poems. There's a series that I took from, you know, my reading. I'd come across these lines that from what to me obscure writers and philosophers, and just seemed really interesting, and I would use the line as a prompt to write the poem. And so, you know, not necessarily reading the line itself, but kind of riffing on it. So these are not epigraphs, but the impetus of the poems. Heraclitus. We cannot know the water, but only its perpetual movement. Overheating cannot be blamed on a faulty idiot light. The car in crisis, beached on the roadside and pouring steam from its blowhole as you watch the rain melt the windshield, the perfect screen for projecting a fantasy dissolve that begins with your jalopy dropped from a barge to be eaten by the reef like a dive site. An hour earlier, this bell jar hummed and clunkered as it sluiced through vacuum tubes lining the riverbed from Manhattan to Hoboken, the interstate peace pipes which lead to the suburban drive-through bank window where you hand-deliver your savings to creditors. You think of self-sabotage, dirigibles bursting the sky in newsreels over Lakehurst, flaming like immolating monks. Our machinery merely echoes our body's disposition, your desire for the tellers to leave their tanks and swim to your rescue, pretty as new money floating ghostly outside the car window as the last pockets of air pinch off and the water gently closes over your head. Saint Augustine, I always get self-conscious. Is it Saint Augustine or Saint Augustine? Thank you. Saint Augustine. If no one asks me, I know what it is. If I wish to explain it to him who asks me, I do not know. Prince calls it little because he imagines a woman's body, waist up, the rest corvette, which is French for a sort of girly warship, a chimerical twist on the Freudian cockpit. Who wouldn't want a belly button for a windshield? All us baby ball turret gunners would submit to mother love as long as we were allowed the illusion that we commanded the vessel. This may be why we give them names like Bessie and Lila May, but our cars are more prosthesis than portmanteau. We say horses that muscle and gun, but idle next to one and hear its sputtering Promethean delirium like a hound's twitching dream of dogfights in biplanes that strafe the velvet sky with the leathery helmets of their little red barons. We would have swooped the oil fields where pilot lights burned like Zippos at a rock concert to safeguard our memories of weekends washing father's vet, fearing both its pliant fire and our need to ride in pursuit of some unconscious joy, certain only that we'd know it if it ever could be found. Occam. Every body has an impetus which allows it to continue to move. Being moved is passing from potential to the act. You often size up the random demographic holiday traffic makes, hoping to see yourself inside a picture bigger than the neighborhood you know. But the knots of cars, strung in rows like Incan quipu, ordain your destination, for they script your possibilities in the Nielsen lingo, abstracted from ad copy instead of the tangible planet. So who is really driving the soapbox you find transporting your thoughts while you inch the highway like the Pope's bubble mobile? Lines at the toll plaza are a poem where you idle in this way, mindless as Sonny Corleone. Every procession ends in a funeral. Think of a chain gang of reindeer and the tiny hands making toys in Santa's maquilas. Will you spend the whole poem reading bumpers and vanity plates, concerned how they outpace you? At the end of this poem, full of furtive glances, will you count yourself among the seers or the seen? No one sees you sleeping but your wife, and for her, you thought of nothing. Look how little you give of yourself, how little of yourself you have been given. So one of the forms that I play with course descriptions in this book, and but I was also tried a rare book description. This book does not exist, by the way. I had a professor come up to me after one of my readings and said, "You know, I've never heard of this book." He felt he had failed in some way, and I had to break it to him. 837, Wilson, Shirley Ann Mfumi, Black Pampers, Raising Consciousness in the Post-Nationalist Home. Black Talk Press, Lawnside, New Jersey, 1976. 442 pages, illustrator unknown, 10.5 by 11.875. Want tips for nursery decor? Masks and hieroglyphics, Aquaba dolls, send Raggedy Ann to the trash heap. This tome is a how-to for upwardly mobile black parents beset with the guilt of assimilation. Revealed here are the safety pinnings of the nascent black middle class, their leafy split-level cribs and infants with Sherman Hemsley hairlines. Of interest are bedtime polemics on the racist derivations of the wheels on the bus. Chapter headings address important questions of the day. How and how soon should you intervene if you suspect your child lacks rhythm? At what age should you begin initiating your little one to the historical memory of slavery? And how ethical is the two-cake solution? One party for classmates and the second so you can invite the cousins. Indispensable to collectors for whom Aesop's African origin is no matter of debate will be the gloss and annotation comprising the bulk of the text of the lyrics to Stevie Wonder's Black Man. According to the jacket copy, one of the alternate titles considered was What to Expect When You're No Longer Expecting Revolution. Usual occasional scattered light foxing to interiors, contemporary tree calf exceptional, about fine condition, $75. So, you'll notice my family came with me, but it was late, and I don't know if my kids were here, that would be just madness. So I'm reading poems about them in their absence. So this is from a series called Marginalia, where this is when I was a new father and anxious about being a parent and how I would inevitably screw this up, as you know, parents do necessarily. And so these are poems that kind of riff on the of course, now it just flies out of my mind. Noah and the son? What's the biblical story I'm trying to think of? Abraham. I'm sorry, thank you. So that this is kind of in the background. Problema 3. The Fulton Street food town is playing Motown, and I'm surprised at how quickly my daughter picks up the tune. And soon the two of us, plowing rows of goods steeped in fructose under light thick as corn oil, are singing, Baby, I Need Your Lovin', unconscious of the lyrics foreboding. My happy child riding high in the shopping cart as if she's cruising the polished aisles on a tractor laden with imperishable foodstuffs. Her cornball father enthusiastically prompting with spins and flourishes and the double barrel fingers of the gunslinger's pose. But we hear it as we round the rice and Goya aisle, that other music, the familiar exchange of anger, the war drums of parent and child. The boy wants what? To be carried? To eat the snacks right from his mother's basket? What does it matter? He's making a scene. With no self-interest beyond the pleasure of replacing wonder with wonder, my daughter asks me to name the boy's offense. I offer to buy her ice cream. How can I admit recognizing the portrait of fear the mother's face performs, the inherited terror of nonconformity, frosted with the fear of being thought disrespected by or lacking the will to discipline one's child? How can I account for both the cultural and the intercultural? The boy's cries rising like hosannas as the mother's purse falls from her shoulder, her missed step from the ledge of one of her stilted heels, passion loosed with each displaced hairpin, his little jacket bunched at the collar where she has worked the marionette. Later, when I'm placing groceries on the conveyor belt, and it is clear I have forgotten the ice cream, my daughter tries her hand at this new algorithm of love, each word punctuated by her little fist. Boy, she commands, didn't I tell you? We can laugh about it now. Problema 4. At 13, I asked my father for a tattoo. I might as well have asked for a bar mitzvah. He said I had no right to alter the body he gave me. aping what little of Marx I learned from the sisters down the street who wore torn black stockings with Doc Martens, I said I was a man because I could claim my body and the value of its labor. This... this meant I could adorn it or dispose of it as I chose. Tattoos, my father said, are like children. Have one, you'll want another. I knew there was a connection between the decorated body and reproduction. This was why I wanted a tattoo. Yet I reasoned, not in so many words, his analogy only held in the case of possession, i.e., I possess my body but cannot possess my children. His laughter was my first lesson in the human Ponzi scheme of paternalism. The self-electing indenture to the promise of material inheritance, men claiming a hollow authority because simply their fathers had claimed a hollow authority. Knowing I had little idea as to what my proposed tattoo might resemble, my father sent me to my room to sketch it using the pastels he had given me for Christmas. Based on his critique, he said, he would consider my request. But he had already taken the shine from my swagger. How can I beautify what I do not possess and call it anything but graffiti? Chris Rock says, my first job is to keep my daughter off the pole. Whether or not I agree with him, I get his point. As a father myself, I now see every mutinous claim of independence as the first steps toward my sweet peas falling in with a bad crowd. Richard Pryor says, we are bound to screw up our kids one way or another. My father would split the difference. I made you, he'd say. I can unmake you and make another one just like you. My dad, the accidental Marxist. This is in honor of the old fountains in front of the Metropolitan Museum. The new fountains are paid for by the Koch brothers. Evil fountains. Wishing well. Thanks again. Outside the Met, a man walks up, sun tweaking the brim sticker on his starter cap, and he says, pardon me, old school. He says, you know, is this a wishing well? Yes, son, I say sideways over my shrug. Throw your bread on the water. I tighten my chest, wheezy as Rockaway beach sand with a pull of faux smoke from my e-cig to cozy the truculence I hotbox alone, and I am at the museum because it is not a bar. Because he appears not to have changed them in days, I eye the heel-chewed hems of his pants and think, probably he will ask me for 50 cents any minute now. Wait for it. A smoke or something. Central Park displays the frisking transparency of autumn. Tracing paper sky, leaves like eraser crumbs gum the pavement. As if deciphering celestial script, I squint and purse off toward the roofline of the museum aloof as he fists two pennies from his pockets, mumbling and then aloud, my man, he says, hey, my man, I'm going to make a wish for you too. I'm laughing now, so what, you want me to sign a waiver? He laughs along, ain't say all that, he says, but you do have to hold my hand and close your eyes. I make a starless night of my face before he asks, are you ready? Yeah, dog, I'm ready. Sure, sure, let's do this. His rough hand in mine inflates like a blood pressure cuff, and I squeeze back as if we are about to step together from the sill of all resentment and timeless toward the dream source of unneeding. The two of us hurtle, sharing the cosmic breast of plenitude when I hear the coins blink against the surface and I cough up daylight like I've just been dragged ashore. "See now, you'll never walk alone," he jokes, and is about to hand me back to the day he found me in, like I was a rubber duck. And he says, "You got to let go." But I feel bottomless, and I know he means well, though I don't believe, and I feel myself shaking my head. No, what he means, let go his hand. Thank you. Thank you very much.